Flow states have triggers. 22 that we know of, there's probably way more. Flow follows focus, shows up when all of our attention is right here, right now. That's what these triggers do. They drive attention into the present moment. And they do it in a lot of different ways, but one of the big ways they do that is that by producing dopamine, which is, as I said, a focusing chemical. It feels like excitement, enthusiasm, and the desire to make meaning up from the present, and right? So all the triggers I was talking about earlier are dopamine triggers. Novelty produces dopamine. Risk taking could be psychological, could be emotional, could be physical risk. Risk is another, because that drives attention to the present moment. Curiosity, passion, purpose, autonomy, because we like being in charge of our own lives.
Hey, everybody. Welcome to Inside Launch Street. Tamara here, your host. So I'm always excited. I got a lot of energy, but I am doubly excited for today's interview. This was a long time in the making. I may have stalked Stephen to get him on this podcast. And I think once you start listening in, you will know why. So as those of you in the community know, I'm all about reaching our highest level of potential through our innovative mind. And Stephen takes it to a whole new level. He's all about human potential, what's possible, making the impossible possible, and understanding peak performance, but not just in the subjective, let's just like all step outside of our comfort zone way, but really based on science and experience and behavioral psychology and all of that. So I'm going to shut up now because I have so many questions for this guy. Stephen, thank you so much for joining me today.
It's good to be with you. Thanks for having me.
Yeah. So why don't you tell our audience, if they don't know you, just a little bit about who you are.
I am a journalist. I'm an author, and I'm the executive director of the Flow Research Collective, where we study the neurobiology of peak human performance. So what's going on in the brain when human beings are performing at their absolute best. And we do this in conjunction with neuroscientists at places like USC, UCLA, Imperial College London. And we take what we've learned and we use it to train everybody from kind of members of the US Special Forces to professional athletes, C-suite executives, I mean, whole executive teams from lots of different Fortune 500 companies all the way to the general public. So we will work with insurance brokers in Delhi. We will work with soccer moms in Indiana. And the reason I mention all that is what it gives us is something wonderful. We have the science on the front end, and then we train about 1,000 people a month. So we have enormous data sets on the back end of what actually, you know, the science will get you 2/3 of the way, but how does it work in the real world is, you know, is often a different thing.
So one of the things I absolutely appreciate about your work is that you've broken it down to understand how do we elevate our performance? How do we get into flow? And so that it's not this magical thing. And I think sometimes like you'll hear these experts out there and they talk about it like they are so fortunate to accidentally like step up their game and the rest of us get to watch them. But you've really found a way to make it, I don't know, systematize it or understand it and how we can unlock it. So I'm curious how you figured that out and how this came to be.
Some of it was accidental. Accidental based on my own personal curiosities. When I came into this work in the early 1990s, two things were fascinating to me. One was action sports, surfing, skiing, rock climbing, snowboarding, and the like. And back in the 1990s, those sports were going through a revolution. It was the era of impossible. More impossible feats than ever before had been done. And what you should be really interested in, it wasn't just that people were doing the impossible, they were iterating upon it. They were doing the impossible, they were innovating on top of it, and on top of it, on top of it. And what caught my attention about these athletes in particular is I knew these people. I was living in Squaw Valley. This was the mecca of that universe. Almost everybody I knew, they came from broken homes, bad childhoods. They had very little money. They had little education. There was a lot of risk taking. There was a lot of high risk behavior. Normally you put those things together in a community of people and what you get is people who die young or go to jail. What you don't get is reinvention of what was possible for the species. And that's what I was witnessing. And I wanted to know why the hell this was happening. And this is where my other sort of fetish, which is the answer to your question, came into play, which was in the 1990s. My other side of me, the science side, was a neuroscience geek. And the 90s were this amazing time in what we would then call behavioral neuroscience. So how do you go from brain activity to actual human behavior in the real world? I wanted to know how human beings worked. That was really what was interesting to me. And most peak performance coaching discussion, blah, 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 has two issues. One, they like to talk about things in terms of psychology. And as useful a science as it is, the vast majority of the time, unless you're actually dealing with expert psychologists talking to expert psychologists, it's metaphor. It's not, they're not talking about mechanism. If you want to make things reliable, repeatable, I can do this, you can do this, anybody can do this, you want mechanism. The second half of that statement is when we say peak performance, when anybody says peak performance, as you pointed out, there's a lot of connotations that come along with it. But when you actually look at the biology, peak performance is nothing more or less than getting our biology to work for us rather than against us. And that's a limited sort of suite of tools. It's vast, but there's a limited set. And that's what we're working with. And they're designed to work in an order in a specific way. And if you could just get all this stuff working for you, you just get farther, faster, with a lot less pause.
So I got a couple questions for you in there. And I want to do a little bit of defining just to get us all on the same page, because like in my world of innovation, I think peak performance and flow are words that if you ask 10 people their definition, you'd probably get 10 different answers. And probably the same person has five answers because we don't really know what it means. How do you define it and how do you look at it?
Well, I define peak performance as getting our biology to work for us rather than against us. Like that's just loosely as an operational. Flow, on the other hand, there's a science, the science of flow, dates back to the late 1870s. In fact, the word flow dates back even earlier in the original German that it was used in, which was Rausch. So this idea is not new. The term is not new. Scientists define flow as an optimal state of consciousness. When we feel our best and we perform our best, that is not a particularly useful definition, but it's a good place to start. More specifically, we are talking about any of those moments of rapt attention, total absorption. You get so focused on the task at hand that everything else just seems to disappear. Time is going to pass strangely. It's going to slow down. You'll get a freeze frame effect or speed up. Self-awareness, self-consciousness, the inner critic, the voice in our heads, can diminish, get really quiet. And throughout all aspects of performance, both mental and physical, are going to just soar through the roof.
So you said, there's a couple of things that you said that's kind of really about like your biology working for you, right? That's kind of peak performance and flow being in that state. So here's my question for you, Stephen. It feels like we're our own worst enemies. Like we self-sabotage ourselves and work against ourselves. And, you know, I've always wondered, you know, is that biology? Is that experience stacking? Is that patterns? Is that just kind of life and what we think we know to be true? And I guess what I'm asking is, how do we break those patterns? Because like peak performance, I want flow. I want peak performance. I want to move forward. Yet I kind of find that sometimes I work against myself. And, you know, the most basic example, and this isn't necessarily with peak performance particularly, but is like, I don't feel well, or I've had a bad day, so I go eat a whole chocolate cake. I know that's a bad habit, but I still go do it anyway, because that's my habit. So I just want to get your perspective on, I mean, is that even, I'm kind of talking in circles here, because there's eight questions in one, but.
There's two issues here. I'll try to answer quickly, but these are really, one issue is we are foundationally humans, homeostatic organisms. We like equilibrium. So anything that takes more energy, we resist. And flow is a high energy state. Peak performance is a high energy state. So getting the body used to performing at that level, right? You hear about in the NBA, they're always talking about, oh, this is a team who thinks they can flip this switch and turn it on comes finals times. Most of us, for whatever reason, seem to think we're actually like NBA basketball players who can flip the switch, and right? And the truth of the matter is, even with NBA basketball players, this is best in the world, top 0.0001% at basketball, there's only a handful of men or women playing professional basketball who have that actual ability. For most of us, the Army has a motto, fight like you train, train like you fight. And it's because you're fighting against your own homeostatic organism. The other half of this is people don't like to say this out loud. They like to use words like habit. Oh, I have this. We are addiction machines. The human body, the human brain is designed to function by addiction. Modern life whether or not we like it, whether or not we want to say it out loud, it is addiction management. When you are trying to not get distracted by the dopamine on your phone, right, generating phone, that's the rough equivalent of a cocaine addiction, right? Low-grade cocaine addiction, right? Those are the battles we fight on a daily basis with our technology, with the way we've designed our lives, with all those other stuff. And you're fighting addictive neurochemistry. You can't, when we say habit, we're like, oh, I've just got this habit. No, you're a habit creature or a habit machine, and your body, your need for equilibrium, will create what William James famously called the habit of inferiority. We will level set, we will think, oh, medium amounts of energy, focus, attention, and kind of self-regulation at the end of the day is what's necessary. And it's not, because of the fact that we function by addiction, because of the fact that we're homeostatic organisms. Until you lay down the habits of excellence, you will slip back towards mediocrity. And once you lay down the habits of excellence, you still can't take them for granted, right? Yeah. Even top, you can't take them for granted. That's what I meant, but there were just very few people who could flip that switch. It doesn't, I was just at Squaw Valley over the past couple of days, and I'm always amazed when I'm there because it snowed on Saturday, and Sunday morning, there's a group of professional athletes on top of the Palisades. It's 9 o'clock in the morning. It's the first run, and they're about to jump 50-foot cliffs. You know what I mean? And you're looking at it and you're like, how are you ever even awake enough to do that, let alone like flip the switch that says, okay, this morning I'm going to drop 60 feet. And if I miss my landing by an inch on either side, I'm going to probably go to the hospital. Okay.
It's not how most of us wake up and think about our day. We need to have another discussion about Lake Tahoe later, because I actually grew up there in North Shore. It's one of my favorite places in the world. So here's my question then. If we're addiction creatures, and I get it, I get what you're saying, and it is so much easier for me to stay where I am, wherever that place is. And I think your point, the one that I want all of us to really pay attention to, is even when we get those habits of excellence, not to take them for granted, because they will go away. But how do we push towards the excellent side and the peak performance side when we are so inundated with these habits on the other side?
It's an interesting question. So as you were talking, I was thinking before I answered this question, because there are good answers. And the short answer to this question is, I just wrote a new book called The Art of Impossible. It is literally a playbook for all this stuff. That's where you'll find that answer. That said, the one thing I want to mention, because it's a show focused on innovation, because there's another side to this coin that I think innovators and creatives have, there's a couple more things that are equally important. The first is that creativity on any level demands openness to experience. It demands higher levels of empathy. It demands higher levels of novelty for a bunch of neurobiological reasons. And that means creatives feel their emotions and tend to go up and down more than most people. This was thought to be the creative personality type for years, but now it's actually better understood as, if you start becoming more creative in the work you do, you might have like become a tax accountant in act one of your life. And then, you know, 5 years in, you're like, oh my God, tax accounting actually demands a tremendous amount of creativity and innovation and creative thinking. And this is not the job. And suddenly you're a creative, because all of us, I think, are in the modern world are sort of going to become that. You're going to get more emotional as a result. So you have to, that level of emotional awareness has to be paid attention to. And with creativity specifically, and we can go, this will bring us back into flow and some of that discussion, but when you're hyper creative, whether it's in flow or just any creativity, it requires pattern recognition to be amplified in the brain. Pattern recognition gets amplified when the brain produces more dopamine and norepinephrine. These are two very powerful neurochemicals. They'll drive focus, they'll enhance pattern recognition, they do a bunch of good things, but they're also addictively pleasurable. And dopamine, when you get creatives on a dopamine high, you have the other opposite. They don't know where the upper boundary is, and they think everything that their ego is creating is true. So you have to learn, when you have that much, we have t-shirts at the Flow Research Collective. We don't have any swag. We have one t-shirt. It says, never trust the dopamine. Because when we work with the best of the best of the best, that's the goal, or we take you and try to help you to get there, because there's a ladder there. But as you climb that ladder, you're going to get more and more dopamine. That is known. The weird thing about flow, yourself and your ego disappears, but when it comes back louder and more ferocious. And that's that artistic creative ego. And you have to learn, hey, this is an occupational hazard now. This is more addiction management. And it's not just about like managing the energy to get in the fight. It's you have to manage the energy inside the fight for two reasons. One, if you burn through all your dopamine, if you ride that ego high to the end, it's going to diminish and it's going to take a while to come back. So there's going to be longer recovery periods. You're going to exhaust yourself. It's not a great way to play this game. And the other thing is, you're going to make bad creative decisions, make bad innovative decisions. You're going to take too much risk. Good risk taking is great. Too much risk, it's a balance. So it's important to understand it's not just about resetting equilibrium higher. It's also, hey, once you do that, there's going to be a bunch of other stuff you're going to unlock. Great superpowers, but they come with responsibilities.
So let me ask you this, because you know, I've heard you talk about this in interviews. And by the way, for all of you listening, The Art of the Impossible is a phenomenal book. I bought it. I've already read it. I've got more highlights than I went through two highlighters, actually. I was like, wow, I should have just highlighted the whole book, but really go get it. But I've also heard you talk about the difference between macro and micro flow and mm-hmm. kind of what those are. Will you talk a little bit about that? Because I think, you know, there's between my weekend warrior me and the flow that I need or the performance that I need to achieve, like just to be on this podcast, do my work.
Right. For sure. That's a great, thank you for bringing this up. So when the work we do, neurobiologists, when we measure flow, we're looking at like tons of different brain waves change, neurochemistry changes, different parts of the brain light up and go quiet. We have network shifts, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. We have physiological signals. That's how we measure flow. When psychologists want to measure flow, they say, okay, the state has six core characteristics, six technically phenomenological characteristics, ways the state makes us feel. Complete concentration on the task at hand, this merger of action awareness, the vanishing of self, time dilation. The peak performance manifests as a feeling of control. So a sense of control, I can control things I can't normally control. This is a skier skiing way above their head, skiing really hard lines. Or this is me as a writer going, wow, I'm doing things with language I don't normally do on a Tuesday morning, right? And finally, the experiences themselves are autotelic. That means an end in itself. It means the experience is euphoric. It's pleasurable. It's so joyous. This is why we know what, you know, psychologists define happiness as three tiers of happiness, but the top two have flow baked into the definition because that's so important to kind of well-being, meaning, purpose, happiness, joy, all that stuff. That psychologists call that autotelic. So back to your point. I'm a psychologist, I want to measure flow. And I say, well, and you just had an experience, how much was complete concentration showed up, you know, on a Likert scale, 0 to 5, right? How much was, did time pass strangely, 0 to 5? Anyways, from all this work and hundreds of thousands of subjects at this point, we now know that flow, like most human experiences, isn't a single experience. It's a spectrum of experiences, and much like anger, right? You're a little irked or you're homicidally murderous. It's the same emotion, different edges of a spectrum. So same thing is true with flow. There's a state of microflow on one end. This is where those six characteristics, the way psychologists define it, all show up. But if you were measuring on a scale, they'd be at like 1 or maybe 2. So this is exactly what you were talking about. You go to work, you sit down with a colleague, you start discussing a hard work problem, you get lost in the discussion, a couple hours go by and you didn't even notice. And so time passed strangely and maybe bodily awareness didn't disappear, like sense of self didn't totally vanish or you didn't become one with everything, which happens on the other end of the spectrum and we'll get there in a second. But bodily awareness disappeared, right? And you're suddenly you pop back into your head and you're like, oh wow, I gotta go run to the bathroom, excuse me. That's really common. On the other end of the spectrum is macro flow. This is when all those characteristics show up and they're dialed up to 10. And this is an extremely powerful, strange experience. And so very strange things can happen. Time will slow down. You'll get a freeze frame effect. And you can also feel one with everything, have out of body experiences, all these things. For a very long time until the 1950s, until they found flow in a giant study group of high-performing atheists, don't ask. They thought this was a mystical experience. They were sure it was a real thing, but it showed up in religious people or spiritual people. It wasn't something that normal people had access to, and then started showing up in studies of creatives, and then it started showing up in studies of expertise, and then it sort of, yeah. So it, and it changed, but for a really long time, I mean, out of body experiences, I'm one with everything. Like now we understand the neurobiology. I can tell you why you feel one with everything or one, why you have an out of body experience and why you have it in flow. Back, you know, when we first started studying this, people didn't know what the hell they were looking at. So they didn't realize it was a spectrum. So as you pointed out, microflow is very common at work. There's studies that show that 5% of us spend, or that all of us spend about 5% of our work life normally in microflow, often without noticing it. So the Flow Research Collective, some of what we do is teach you, how do you identify flow in yourself? And once you can start figuring out, oh, I'm in microflow, how can you go from micro towards, it's hard to go from micro to macro, but you can definitely turn up the volume and extend your microflow state or deepen it.
So I'd love to dig in a little bit on that, because I think the question on a lot of our minds is, well, how do I activate it, right? And what was coming to my mind was two things for me. One is when I run, I've been training for an Ironman. When I run, I only get into flow when I run the runner's high, basically, or at that level of like, I am crushing it at mile six and on. I can't figure out how to activate it earlier. So that's kind of like on the physical
how
side.
Could I ask you a question? How fast are your miles?
I mean, I wouldn't call them fast at all. I would call them 11:35s.
Okay. I mean, I can answer that. So one, you're running on the street or on a track. You're not running on trails, I don't think.
No, I'm in Denver, so I'm on the street.
Okay. Yeah. So you could increase your time into like the time it takes to get into flow by taking it, by increasing the amount of like novelty, complexity, unpredictability, or risk in your route. If you're just that, and I could come back to that, but yeah, you're right. You're basically running yourself. So there's something known as exercise-induced transient hypofrontality. This is the front end of a flow state. It's when your brain gets very quiet. It's about 20 minutes into exercise. You get a nitrous oxide release, your lungs open up, and it gets quiet upstairs. This is the front edge of a flow state. It takes the body 20, 25 minutes normally to get there. But if you're really fit and all you're doing is running and you're running at an even pace mile because you're trying to train for an Ironman where you're actually going to do three stages, blah, blah, blah. That will, you're right. You're not getting any high until your brain gets exercise induced transient hypofrontality about a half an hour in, maybe 40 minutes in. And then probably not for a while because most triathletes, so there's an S&M produced flow high, especially for bottoms, that they call flying or whatever. It's a pain induced flow high. That's exactly the same flow high that endurance athletes get into. It's no different. You're riding pain and the focus that pain produces in the brain into flow. And thus the pain relieving chemicals, endorphins and anandamide, would show up a little later in a flow state, are what you're kind of waiting for. And that's your trigger. You could get them earlier, but it requires dopamine in the system. And that would require novelty, complexity, unpredictability, and some other stuff.
All right, so you just totally blew my mind, because I'm basically doing it to myself because I'm just doing the same, right? It's repetitive. So here's my question then. So fascinating to me. So that kind of novelty, that complexity, that unpredictability, is that what helps us on the...
Let me back this up and explain what the hell I just said and why I just said it. So everybody can do...
I was thinking about that and I was like, well, does that relate to work too?
It does. It does in weird ways. And I'll give you an example. So flow states have triggers, preconditions that lead to more flow. If you want more flow in your life, there's a bunch of... So flow is not synonymous with peak performance. So there's more going on in peak performance. Flow is necessary, but not sufficient for peak performance. So we're only talking about one quarter of an actual four-part equation. That said, in this particular chunk of the equation, flow states have triggers. 22 that we know of, there's probably way more. Flow follows focus, shows up when all of our attention is right here, right now. That's what these triggers do. They drive attention into the present moment. And they do it in a lot of different ways, but one of the big ways they do that is that by producing dopamine, which is, as I said, a focusing chemical. It feels like excitement, enthusiasm, and the desire to make meaning up from the present, and right? So all the triggers I was talking about earlier are dopamine triggers. Novelty produces dopamine. Risk taking could be psychological, could be emotional, could be physical risk. Risk is another, because that drives attention to the present moment. Curiosity, passion, purpose, autonomy, because we like being in charge of our own lives. Though et cetera, et cetera. These are all ways of getting dopamine into the system. So is creativity. So I'll come back to running in a second. When we link ideas together, pattern recognition, we get a little squirt of dopamine. And we've had this experience cognitively. If you've ever done a crossword puzzle or Sudoku, you get an answer right, there's a little rush of pleasure. That's dopamine, right? And why do you tend to get two or three or four answers right in a row when you're doing a crossword puzzle that come in spurts? It's because dopamine amplifies pattern recognition. So you put together the pattern, you solve the first one, get a little dopamine reward high. Oh, you notice the pattern here, have a reward, and you notice two or three more patterns, and then the chemical sort of burns out and you start again, right? And so that's how we tend to solve problems. That's one of the reasons creative ideas spiral. One idea leads to the next, leads to the next, leads to the next. That's why creativity soars so much in flow, because there's a lot of dopamine and it's doing this in flow. Let me give you a couple of business examples of how this works rather than running examples. So I have to, as you can see from the shelf behind me, read a lot of neuroscience textbooks to do my job. As you might imagine, they are the most exciting, thrilling, page-turning, enthralling, captivating textbooks you've ever encountered in your entire life. And flow, among its many attributes, one of the things that it does is it significantly increases learning and memory rates. Department of Defense did a bunch of studies on soldiers in flow. They will find on average learning and it will increase 250 to 500% above normal. It's a huge spike. It happens because the neurochemicals tend to tag experience. We have an experience with lots of neurochemistry, an emotional experience. All those neurochemicals that produce the emotion, they also do double duty as tags. Hey, this is important. Save it for later, right? Flow is this huge neurochemical dump. So anything that happens to us, we tend to remember. So one of the things that is very true about anybody's life is if you remember, look back on your life and think about a lot of the great things that happen that are stuck in your memory, they happen in flow states. Yeah. Because flow is this huge amplification of neurochemistry and it locks it into memory. They're important highs, basically. And so we tend to remember them. We tend, you know, I can tell you the first profound macro flow state I ever had. I was 13 years old. I was skiing at Seven Springs and the girl I had a crush on, who was also 13, was on the chairlift. I can tell you the color of her ski suit. It's 30 years later or 40. Yeah, it's 30 years later, 40 years later.
I thought you were going to tell me your brother's magic trick.
No, I could tell you that one too. So when you're running, we used to do this. I'll give you I've worked with a bunch of college football coaches. Mm-hmm. And flow massively amplifies pattern recognition and strength and all this stuff that you want football players practicing in flow. Their injury rates go down, among other things. But what coaches normally do at a football practice is, okay, everybody go run a half a mile to warm up, right? That's the warm up, standard warm up, where you do stretches and calisthenics, and then everybody go run a couple miles. So what we've started to do is just take it off trail, just vary it. So you have more novelty, more complexity. And with linemen, I say things like, look, if these guys can't turn the natural woods into an obstacle course because they're 300 pounds, it's hard to run around the woods nimbly. Have them do things like somersaults on the trail or like little 360s or pirouettes. It doesn't matter. You're looking for novelty, complexity, and unpredictability. And if you introduce that, people will come back from their warm-up run. They don't even have to run that fast, but they'll come up closer to or in flow than before. So you can do the same thing if you start varying how you approach your runs or whatever, because you stick with the same pattern over and over and over again. This is where Anders Ericsson's work on deliberate practice, repeating the same thing over and over and over again, runs into, kind of bashes into the flow work. And Anders and I have talked before he passed, we've discussed this, but where you make those variations and form is really complicated and just takes a lot of self-awareness and practice.
Is this why when I work, and I hear this from other people too, it's not just me, you know, when I go to a cafe to work for a couple hours.
This was the neuroscience thing that I never finished. So I got to read all these freaking textbooks. They're generally boring and I need to remember a lot and I want to be in flow, right? Because that's the only way I'm going to do it. So what do I do? If I've got really tough shit to read, it's really hardcore, I will check into a hotel room. I'll go someplace like Squaw Valley. I'll get a porch that looks out onto the mountain. So I have perceptual vastness, which triggers complexity. I look at a mountain and I see geological time. So that will give me complexity. Anything can happen when you're mountain weather, all kinds of whatever. That's a little unpredictability. It's a novel environment. And all these things start producing dopamine. Then I start reading. And if I connect a couple of the ideas in the book to things I already know about, oh, look, this applies to flow and blah, blah, blah. That's pattern recognition. And now I'm dropping into flow. Very common to get into flow while reading. It's a very common flow state, but turning it up a little bit so it's a really powerful flow state, so you're getting memory enhancement. One of the ways you know you're in flow when reading, by the way, is it's not just you're totally focused and enthralled. It's your ideas are, you've got creative ideas popping into your head as you're reading, right? The material you're reading becomes fodder for innovation. That's how you know you're in reading flow. And that's, it's the same things I'm telling you to do with your running. You just want to do it kind of with how you approach the text. You still need complete concentration, right? You don't want to, if you go to the cafe, you don't want to start talking to strangers, right? You want to stay really focused in your little bubble and absorb the novelty, but not get distracted by it. Again, there's some addiction management. You want a little, but too much. And you're just like, oh, check him out. Check her out. Look at those shoes. You walk in those, right? You can't do that.
So Stephen, this is, first of all, this is so powerful. I got a couple other questions for you here, but I just want to summarize this section because we're talking about running, we're talking about reading, but it applies to everything that we do. And I would suggest to all of us out there listening that right now, more than ever, that getting into that state of flow, and to your point, it's a spectrum. So whether it's at a micro level or a macro level, is becoming more important to us and our ability to get our jobs done, to achieve the things we want to achieve. So it's
let me say two things on this tip, because just so people can understand how much or how little this actually applies to them. Yeah. One, two, three things are worth knowing. McKinsey did a 10-year study, self-reported, so little grain of salt, but they went around the world talking to top executives. How much more productive are you in flow? The average response was 500% more productive. That's a massive spike. That's insane.
Yeah.
Is point A. Two, Adam Grant just reported in the New York Times that the number one predictor of who came out the other side of COVID, be able to flourish, not burnt out, not emotionally destroyed, able to flourish. The number one indicator was, did you find a high flow activity at the start of COVID? Those who found high flow activities to get absorbed into their work, they survived the quote unquote languishing, which is I think the new psychological term they're using. They thrived under languishing conditions better. And the final thing that's sort of worth pointing out is Gallup has done really good worker engagement surveys, right? And what did they learn? That 80% of American workers are disengaged or actively disengaged on the job. But the other side of that is the remaining 20%, people who love what they do, show up early, stay late, can't stop, our dream employees or dream bosses or whatever. These are people who have high flow jobs. They have found a way to do their job so that there's a tremendous amount of flow in the job.
Oh my gosh, there's so much. There's one thing I want to talk about, and then I do want to make sure to get into the art of the impossible and the quartet, as you call them, because you said it falls apart. So I don't want to run out of time for that. But you know, you talked about getting through COVID. One of the things I heard you say in an interview was about getting into a state of flow actually helps you, because I'm going to botch it up, so you're going to have to say it the right way. But that basically helps you process all that sensory input, or that is the time. Am I getting that right?
No. Well, you might be getting something right, but I'm not. In flow, we do, in all aspects of information processing in the brain, the state itself surrounds it. So we take in more information per second, we process it more quickly, more completely, we find farther flung connections, blah, blah, blah. So it's very important in the modern world, because our brains are local and linear machines designed for very slow, orderly change millions of years ago. We don't live in that world anymore. We live in a global and exponential world. Nothing is local and linear, it's global and exponential. And the brain cannot keep pace with the modern life. Flow allows us to do that. So that might be what you heard me say.
Yeah, no, thank you. It was in my head correctly, but it didn't come out right. But yes, But I also, and the reason I wanted to bring that up, and you kind of alluded to about getting through COVID too, because I think that to your point, like the future is here. There are things that we think are only being imagined that are actually happening. And the rate of change is becoming hard for us to deal with as humans, for a lot of us. It's getting hard to deal with. And it feels like those who are kind of able to push forward are those who figured out how to adapt and pivot, but also just how to make sense of it all. And then there's, you know, those with a head in the sand that are looking for yesterday's normal.
I think that's true. And neither are bad approaches, meaning there's nothing wrong with saying, hey, I performed better when things were slower. I perform better when things are slower. Six of my books are on disruptive cutting edge technology. I work on cutting edge technology. I have as little personal technology in my life as possible. I go for days without checking my phone, without checking messages. I'm an introvert. I wall myself off from all of that because I like, and it's, you know, this is just how I met, because you need complete concentration for flow. So I want to wall myself off from the distraction because that's how I work best. Other people are different, right? That's the personality side of this, where biology scales. There's certain things that work for everybody. There's other things that are personality based, and that's individual. You got to figure out what is going to work for you. I love the speed of life and love keeping pace, and I will choose the kinds of challenges that allow me to keep pace with the world, but to do that and to keep that pace, I have to wall myself off from a lot of it as well. I think everybody's got to find that balance, and it's got to be right. If you're constantly feeling like I can't keep up with the modern world, well, you're probably up against hard biological limits for how you're wiring, which is not to say that you can't learn to work faster. That's one of the things about expertise, about performance. You learn to work faster, but it's not quick, right? You don't suddenly wake up tomorrow and like, oh, wow, I can work twice as fast. You can probably work 5 or 6 or 7 or 10 times as fast, but it's going to take a couple of years worth of practice and training to start getting there. And you can't do it overnight. And if you're trying to do it overnight, you're going to fail. So then you want to start walling yourself off and saying, okay, this is where I thrive. Right. You know, I'll stretch a little. But you got to stay within so that sweet spot. We're designed to push to the edge of our skill sets, and that's how we get better. But everybody's got an individual edge. You can't let society dictate where your edge is just because you have a boss or a spouse or a work for a company where they want, if you don't work at that, if that's not where you are, you got to go someplace that matches your pace. Because if you can learn to turn it up, but it doesn't happen quickly, and it's really hard to do, right? If you join a really fast-paced company and you're a slow-paced person, sure, you can learn to keep up, but you're not going to be able to do it there. You have to learn. You have to go elsewhere. You wouldn't go compete with a professional basketball team if you were still in high school. You would lose. It's the same thing with a moderate-moving person trying to join Google.
Yeah, you know what, Stephen? I feel like if we had a live studio audience, you'd hear a collective sigh of relief, because I think so many of us are under this pressure of, I have to now keep up. I have to keep up versus saying, all right, how do I thrive? Why am I feeling overwhelmed? And then how do I manage that? I want to flip gears. I really want to make sure we talk about the art of the impossible. And I really want to talk about the quartet, because that was really eye-opening for me. First of all, what do you hope people get out of this book?
That's so interesting. I mean, the book is a, I don't know what I hope people get out of the book. What I wrote the book because I think if 30 years in studying peak performance has taught me kind of two overwhelming truths. The first is that we are biologically designed for peak performance. We're kind of biologically designed for amazing. We really are. We're designed to go after big, high, hard challenges. That's what the system is built for. And not going after these high, hard challenges, not using the system the way it was designed to be used, has consequences, negative consequences. It's like a vacuum cleaner. It's designed to inhale dirt. You can use it to hammer a nail, right? It will hammer the nail. Sooner or later, you're going to crush the vacuum cleaner. This is obvious, right? You want to use the system the way it's been designed to use. That's what that quartet is. It's a system designed to work in a certain way. So that, I think, is part of what we're trying to get at here.
So let's talk about the quartet then, right? Let me make sure I get it right. Motivation, learning, creativity, and flow. We just talk a little bit about those.
For sure. So when I said earlier, peak performance is nothing more than getting our biology to work for us rather than against us, that is a limited set of skills. And there are four skill sets. There's motivation, and motivation is a catch-all term, right? Scientists say motivation. They don't just mean energy for action, which is how you translate, define the word. They mean extrinsic motivation, like money, sex, fame, things I'm going to work for in the world. Intrinsic motivation, curiosity, passion, purpose, things that drive me from inside. They also mean goals and grit. There's also a second set of learning skills, creativity skills, and finally flow skills. We've talked about some of the flow skills, so you understand some of those components. Yeah. And this is the full suite of cognitive peak performance. This is when we talk about peak performance in the brain, there's nothing to talk about that doesn't fall into one of these four categories, because this is, and there's evolutionary reasons for it. And it's about, you know, a lot of it has to do with how human beings are designed to respond to scarcity. And there's only a couple appropriate responses. You can fight over dwindling resources. You can get creative and get innovative and make new resources. So evolution is driven forward by scarcity. Anything that solves that problem is essentially what we've been optimized for. And that what solves that problem is motivation, because it gets us into the game. Learning is allows us to continue to play. Creativity, especially when you're going after high hard goals, and you, where are they? How do I get there? You need, that's creativity is how we steer. And flow is optimal performance, how we amplify the results sort of beyond all reasonable expectations. One caveat, one thing that's worth pointing out here, it's really actually remarkably easy to train flow. We measure flow pre and post with everybody we train, and we'll get on average about a 70-80% boost in flow. This is your biology. It's designed to do this. We will naturally move in this direction. We're just augmenting what the body does naturally. The problem is it's not stable. I can massively jack you up. You're going to go 100 times faster than ever before. But I always explain it's like a Model T, right? If I take a Model T car and I turbo boost the engine and I keep those skinny ass tires, right? Yeah, the car can now do 100 miles an hour. It's fantastic. But how long until the whole thing explodes? Right. Same thing. If you don't have like the motivation, grit, skills, and all that, you can't stabilize it. Learning. Flow requires us to use our skills to the utmost again and again and again. Well, if you can't learn, you don't have good ways of acquiring new knowledge or acquiring new skills. You can't keep pace. And what ends up happening is you get a lot of flow in the front end. Oh, this is super cool. And then it gets cut off because you can't learn fast enough to keep pace with it. And flow is the most addictive state on earth. It's the best pleasure we get to feel. And if I start producing a lot of it in your life and then it gets cut off, you're faced with a deep depression. It's like, I always say that the thing about peak performance is it's not, self-help is like, I can make a 5 to 10% improvement in your life and no sweat. Like if you screw up your daily gratitude practice or your daily mindfulness practice, you're not going to, it's like you maybe have feel more anxiety than normal, but it's not going to kind of trigger a huge addictive reaction. Peak performance is different. There's some responsibility that comes with this work. And to do it responsibly, you have to train up the full quartet.
So I have a question from one of our Academy members, and I've got a question about gratitude for you as well. So hold on, let me get my glasses on so I can actually read it. Is there a way as a leader I can trigger those around me or help them to realize what they're capable of, peak performance, flow? Is it possible to help others get into a stronger place? That's a great question.
The answer is yes, and at every level. So for example, there's significant research that says when a good team leader is in flow, much greater chance that the entire team itself will be in flow. There are caveats. That's not always true with educators. So flow usually takes place when we're at the edge of our skill sets. So you'll see this in high school all the time. The teacher will be in flow, right? Because but when the teacher's in flow, it means they're like spouting on the edge of knowledge. But it's freaking high school students. And they're like, no, man, I'm barely hanging on, man. So in high school, it's actually really tricky. When teachers in flow, oftentimes students are not. And so like a leader, an educator has to know these things. There's some knowledge required, but yes, that. There's ways to design high flow workspaces. And this is not new. Patagonia's been doing this for a long time. Toyota, Microsoft, a lot of companies have been playing this game for a very long time, literally like back to the 1990s. So this is not new. Certain things that work, certain things that don't work. Some of it's individual based on what your organization is like, all that stuff. The flow triggers work for everybody, and there's two sides of flow. There's individual flow, me in a flow state, or tomorrow in a flow state, and there's group flow, us in it, one together, right? Interpersonal flow, two people talking, or team flow, a team performing at their best, and so forth. So it's also group flow triggers. So an effective leader knows that when you run a meeting, you want to be deploying those group flow triggers as much as possible, because it's going to help put the team into flow. And you'll notice, by the way, if you go look at the group flow triggers, they're broken down in Art of Impossible. We hear a lot about psychological safety today. Yeah. And right, you have to feel safe at work before. Well, a lot of those group flows, some of that is true, some is not actually, but the stuff that is true, it directly aligns with the flow work.
It's
not that the psychological stuff, safety stuff is untrue. I'll give you a simple example. So one of the group flow triggers is equality of skills. So if you've got a team who's going to climb a mountain together, right? If two of the climbers are great and one of the climbers sucks, the climber who sucks is going to be struggling to keep up, and the climbers who are great, right? So there's not skill equality. The problem with companies is people can come into the company and, right, I don't feel safe is code for I don't work hard enough, or I can't keep up, or if I don't know how to do that, right? Like, so the excuses that get blamed on psychological safety are nonsense. And the problem is, it's how you build a team. How you build your teams are what determine the flow that you can get in your teams. But it's really difficult if you're, for example, you know, my Flow Research Collective, 70 people who work with me, right? And we're onboarding new talent all the time. And obviously they're at different skill levels than the top performers in the company. So I just don't try to put them on teams together where they have to keep up with each other. It doesn't work well that way. Some people thrive in that environment. Most people do not. You have to actually be a really sort of competitive type A peak performer to thrive. If you put me in a group of people, I like to be the second best performer in the group.
Yeah,
I like to have one person above me who I can chase, but I want a bunch of people below me who are chasing me. That's my sweet spot. I do the best there. Everybody's different. Right. So you got to figure that stuff out, and that it's important to how you build your teams and things like that.
And I'd also say, if you're the rabbit, right, if you're the top person and you've got someone, the weakest link, it's also frustrating for you because you're constantly needing to like push other people up too.
Yes.
I got another question, and it's actually similar to what I was going to ask, which is talk about gratitude. You've talked about it a few times. Why is that so important? And I'm going to add to that, which is gratitude versus affirmation.
So gratitude works, affirmation does not. And here's why. So we do work with a really brilliant neuroscientist, Glenn Fox. Dr. Glenn Fox is at USC, and he's probably the world's leading expert on gratitude. And gratitude, there's a direct correlation between people who have regular gratitude practice and people who have a high flow lifestyle. But the simple version is this: anxiety blocks peak performance. Too much anxiety will block flow, it drops peak performance, it blocks everything. Little bit is great, increases focus, primes the brain for learning, but it's a very thin line. And because flow takes place at the edge of our skill sets, where we're pushing on our skills to the utmost, that's already a high anxiety spot. So if you have any excessive anxiety in the system, it's going to be too much. You're going to overload the system. You're going to block flow. So peak performers usually have a daily nervous system tune-up. And psychology has been really good on this research. We know you want to tune up your nervous system, you have three choices: regular exercise, mindfulness, meditation, breath work, or gratitude. And you can do a 5-minute gratitude practice, you can do 11 to 20 minutes of focused meditation, or you can do 20 to 40 minutes of exercise. You're exercising to loop back to where we started until you reach exercise-induced transient hypofrontality. When it gets quiet upstairs, when your lungs open up, the nitric oxide that gets released flushes stress hormones out of your system. So that's what you're going for when you're using exercise to try to, like, it doesn't matter how much exercise you get, you're trying to fix your brain. So you basically have to keep going until it's quiet up there. Gratitude will usually do it in about 5 to 7 minutes. There's a bunch of different ways. And what we tell people is, look, under normal conditions, do one a day. if you're freaking out because it's COVID or whatever, do two or three. At the start of COVID, I had everybody on my staff making sure they did three a day. If you worked for me, you were getting regular exercise, doing a daily gratitude practice and doing a mindfulness practice, or you weren't going to work with us during COVID because there was no way I thought you were going to keep it together. I couldn't keep it together, right?
I was going to say, I'll be submitting, I haven't done a resume in years, but I'll be submitting my job application shortly. So real quickly on the gratitude, you said affirmations don't
work. So let's talk about why. Let's talk about what this is. We have a limited time, so I'll try to do it quickly. So the short version of this, your brain has a phenomenal built-in bullshit detector. So if you are doing an affirmation and it's, I'm a millionaire, and our brain is looking back at you in the mirror going, shut up, dude, man, you work at Walmart, okay? You're making minimum wage, okay? And you drink too much, right? Like, you know, you can't lie to yourself. And what happens is that's actually massively demotivating. It takes you in the other direction. Gratitude is shit that already happened. I am so happy and grateful I woke up this morning with enough energy and vitality I could do a podcast, right? Like, that's true. I'm doing a podcast. I woke up with enough, right? Like, it's a true thing. Your brain goes, oh. And what it basically happens is your brain goes, look at all these true good things that you're mentioning. These are real. Maybe it's not, the world isn't such a scary place. So you start noticing non-threatening, non-fearful stuff, and you're getting more novelty. So really, gratitude for creatives is key, because the brain basically is going to let in either shit that scares you or shit that you're, that moves you towards your goals, and fear will win. Fear will, it's more powerful as a general rule than goals. But, and that's most of what gets filtered, makes it up through consciousness, is our fears or our goals. And it's often an either or. And gratitude says, hey, wait a minute, man, you don't need to be all that scared. Look, it's not that bad. There's good things going on. So you start noticing more of the good, less of the bad. So gratitude starts tilting you towards optimism over time. And a little bit of optimism is phenomenal for performance. Too much, you start, you know, you get into that dopamine ego thing and you start thinking everything's wonderful. Too much is a little harmful. You want a balance. But so that's sort of why gratitude works. Affirmations don't. And if you're the wrong kind of person, meaning your bullshit detector weighs heavy on you kind of thing, affirmations will really push you in the wrong direction soon.
I'm just going to close out this and then we're going to say where to go and connect with you. I did affirmations for years and had the opposite results. Switched to gratitude and everything changed. And there's a million other things that came into play, I'm sure. But the fact that gratitude isn't just about being thankful, it's about also being more creative, being more open to new ideas. And I mean, and getting over that bullshit detector, like all of that. So, okay, I could ask 10 more questions, but we're out of time. Stephen, where do you want to have people go connect with you, find out more about your work, get your book, which we should all do?
So Arden Boswell is available, you know, everywhere. Amazon is your friend here, or support your local independent bookstores, please. Especially the ones that managed to stay open through COVID. Flowresearchcollective.com will get you anything you want to know about flow. If you want to train with us, if you want, go to the video page, the learning page, free everything. You can watch me go blah, blah, blah for hours and hours and hours for free if you're so inclined. I'm sorry for you if you are, but, and StephenKotler.com will get you everything that I'm involved in. So those are the best resources.
I got to say, thank you so much. It was very insightful, but I also think that the work that you do is very important to all of us. It leads to more joy and satisfaction out of our life too. I mean, we're humans, right? We like to push ourselves. So, and I think we need more of that in our lives right now. And we need more joy, we need more satisfaction, we need more proof that we're capable of so much more. And that's really the work that you do. So thank you for joining me. It was really just, I wish I was able to take, I'm gonna have to go back and listen to my own podcast for once.
That was sweet. Thank you, it was fun hanging out. I appreciate you.